Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to the show. Now, first up is our relationship coach, Frank Kermit, talking about speed dating and just how much it can help you when it comes to interacting with other people. If you're a shy and quiet person, this is a great activity to help you get out of your shell and meet new people. We then chat with our dietitian, Kim Airy, about dietary detoxes. Are they really good for you or actually dangerous for your body? Kim has all the answers. And then we wrap things up with an awesome remix from Jess Wright, Dance All Night.
Capture your need for sound.
When it comes to losing weight, a lot of people are looking at dietary cleanses to begin changing their eating habits. But are there risks associated with dietary cleanses? Consulting dietitian Kim Airy joins us to talk about detox diets. Kim, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for asking me.
So, Kim, can you tell us about some of these detox diets that you have seen or heard about?
Oh, I've heard about all kinds of them. I've got someone I know is doing a 15-day juice challenge, and I know other people who are doing different ones where they are eating specific foods. Some are fasting. I've had one person I know that went on a fast and only had bouillon for like 2 weeks. Very, very different.
Now, this obviously seems to be all the rage these days, you know, and I think especially because a lot of celebrities get behind these things. Do they actually improve your health or are they dangerous? Because to me, some of them sound super scary.
Well, actually, we don't have any scientific data that say that they're healthy for us. And as a matter of fact, our bodies actually come equipped with a really sophisticated system that's going to help it to detoxify itself. So we really need to rely on our liver. That's going to remove toxins from our body, our kidneys and our urinary tract. That's another way we excrete toxin is in urine. And also in our intestines, that will help us to eliminate toxins and waste products. So I think our body is supposed to be doing this on a regular basis. We really have no evidence to say they're good for us. But on the other hand, when we look at how lousy they can be for us, well, there we have a lot more evidence. We know that some people, particularly if you have a medical condition, there are some people, if they're really healthy and they do this for, you know, fast for a day or something, it's not likely to cause a problem. But some of these juice fasts can lead to diarrhea, which could dehydrate you, and that could cause a problem. Other people, it could send their blood pressure plummeting, which if you have high blood pressure, even if you already just have normal blood pressure, it goes down too low. You can have dizzy spells and pass out. It can also cause big changes in blood sugar levels. And so certainly anybody who has any kind of medical problem should definitely stay away from them. Other people, I couldn't recommend them, but it's a little harder for me to maybe dissuade them.
Now, in your opinion, as Kim Airy, dietitian, would you stay away from them?
Oh, I'm not going near any of them.
Okay. That's good to know, because I think so many people just get caught up in this celebrity culture where, you know, this one and that one is doing it, and if they're doing it, and of course they weigh like 90 pounds dripping wet, so everyone thinks, you know, that this is the thing to do. And I'm so glad you brought up the fact that it's just like your own body was built to take care of things.
I think that this brings into question, though, another thing, which is why are we putting so many toxins in? And I'm going to talk about what we choose to eat. You know, I see a lot of people that go on these detox diets, but my God, I mean, how much junk do they eat when they're not on them? So maybe if you didn't put, you know, maybe if you were eating a balanced diet, maybe if you were choosing better foods to start with or more nutrient-dense foods to start with, then maybe you wouldn't, you know, need or feel the need to do this detoxing.
Can people lose weight? I mean, obviously, I think that's for sure. People lose weight on these detox diets. But I guess my question would be then, it's not really healthy weight that they're losing, right?
Well, I think the issue is you're going to lose weight on a detox diet if it's got less calories in than what you're already eating, okay? So if you're usually eating 4,000 calories a day and you go on a 1,200 calorie a day detox program, you're going to lose weight. But if you're used to eating 1,200 calories a day and you go on a 1,200 calorie a day detox program, you're not going anywhere.
Right.
Okay. What might happen, though, is because you're consuming less sodium, usually in these kind of programs, and because of that kind of thing, changes in mineral balance and that kind of thing, you may lose a lot of water. So losing a lot of water weight is not a good idea, because simply put, as soon as you start eating again, anywhere near anything normal, you're going to put a lot of that weight back on. If you actually are losing weight, let's say you're used to having a much higher caloric intake and you go on the detox diet, the other thing that can happen is you're going to start actually losing muscle mass. So you lose weight, you lose muscle mass and not fat mass, and that actually leads you to end up having a higher percentage of body fat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is worse.
Okay. And a couple of questions. I guess this is a two-part question. If you are sort of doing these cleanses, because I think a lot of people get onto these cleanses where it's like either they do it twice a year or they do it four times a year or every time the season changes, like whatever their sort of schedule in their head is. If you continue to do this, can you sort of screw up your body where, you know, it's doing this, but then it's going back to whatever you were doing before anyway? So it's like this yo-yo thing, almost like a yo-yo diet in a way.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's a yo-yo diet. And we know that ultimately seems to ultimately lead to weight gain long term. It seems to ultimately lead to a much more of a cycle of restriction and then binging, you know, where you restrict and you're so restrictive for a few weeks that when you start eating again, you just kind of go, you know, bananas and eat everything. And we know that kind of a cycle is not usually healthy. It leads to all or nothing thinking, which is, you know, either things are very, very good or they're very, very bad, and there's no, you know, kind of middle ground. And we know in nutrition there's a lot of middle ground. You know, there's some foods that are really high density nutrients and low calorie and really good for you. We know there's some foods that are high in nutrients but also high in calories, so maybe if you're challenged with your weight, not such a great choice. And then we know there's a bunch of foods that have, you know, either lots of calories and no nutrition or no nutrition and no calories, but they don't actually do much for you. So there's a whole spectrum of foods in there that you can choose from, and there's not a lot really of black and white.
What's your opinion on this, Kim? Because it's sort of timely that this is coming up, our conversation, because I actually have a couple of friends who decided to go not really on a cleanse, but I guess we could call it a minor cleanse, where just this month, right this instant, they have launched themselves, I think three or four of them, to not have any sugar for the month. Like they are, like, I mean, apart from, you know, if it's in a fruit, then that's fine. But they're, you know, not putting any sort of sugar in their tea or making sure they're not having any chocolate bars or any of that sort of stuff. And they're doing this for 30 days. Is that anything to maybe be okay with because it's just one specific thing? Or again, in 30 days, will they maybe be like, hey, I haven't had sugar for a month and woohoo, like bring on the chocolate?
Well, you know, that's a whole question of attitude. And I think it really depends on your attitude. I have some clients that have used this kind of a way of thinking where, well, it's okay, well, for 30 days, I'm going to see how I feel about not eating sugar. I'm going to practice for 30 days. It's part of a detox. It's part of a whatever. But I'm going to do it for 30 days. At the end of 30 days, I get to reevaluate. If I find I did really well without the sugar and I don't really want it, well, then I'll just have it whenever I feel like it and it's not such a big deal. Or, you know, if I'm saying, oh, I can't, then a lot of times that leads us to say, oh my God, I just can't. Now the 30 days are over. I just can't wait to have it. That's one of those things that we have to really work on, is how we frame this in our minds and if we want to use it as a jumping off point. As I said, I've had a couple of clients that have used this kind of way of thinking as a jumping off point, and it's given them a chance to look at what they're eating, you know, stop and think about what they're eating.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that taking becoming more conscious of what you're eating is, and taking a step back and looking at it, is really important.
Joining us on the show is consulting dietitian Kim Airy. Make sure to check out her website, kimairy.com. Kim, can you get addicted to doing these cleanses? I'm sure that, you know, for some people, maybe this is like, woohoo, we're going to do this, like we said, six times a year.
Oh, well, you know, I think I'm not so sure it's as much an addiction as much as it's a kind of a justifying, well, I ate junk for the last 6 months and now I'm going to fix it.
Right.
And, you know, we're all about quick fixes nowadays, and we're all about doing things, you know, not necessarily doing things mindlessly. And so now that means because I did my cleanse and I fixed me up now and I'm all good. Now I can go and spend the next 4 months not thinking of what I'm eating and just putting whatever junk I want into me. And then I'll fix it up again in 4 months.
Okay. And, you know, before I sort of move away from this topic, I just wanted to bring this up or this sort of question to you is a lot of these detoxes I find are very liquid based. You know, it's drink celery juice or kale juice or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Is the thinking behind that, well, I'm not eating solid food, so it's allowing my body to take the energy it would have taken to eat the solid food to, like, do this cleanse business?
I'm really not sure what the thought is, because there doesn't seem to be any scientific justification for this, and I certainly can't find any data on why we'd want to do it this way. Certainly all the nutrients are in the food. You know, the nutrients are in the kale, whether it's juiced or not, and your body has to process them. The sugar is there, and your body has to process it. So I'm really not too sure. The only thing that's not there or not really there in quantity and is in a more digestible form is the fiber. And from that point of view, I'm not too sure why, again, we're looking to get rid of it.
I guess similar to this detox, you know, topic is the art of craving, I think, or the fact of craving, because I think so many people, you know, every single human being has had a craving at some point in their life. Now, with that fact, you know, it usually seems that it comes down to either salty foods or sweet. Is there a way for people to stop those cravings? And where, maybe, I don't know, like, scientifically, do they come from, the cravings?
Well, you know, there's a couple of theories about where cravings come from. We're really not sure. One is, for example, for salt, your taste buds kind of become adjusted to the taste. If you have really salty food, your taste buds kind of become adjusted to that. And then when you take salt, remove salt, then you're kind of are not tasting anything. So then you start to crave the salt. There are some theories that that's a way of your body telling you you need a certain nutrient. There's also some theories that suggest we're addicted to some foods, that those foods stimulate the pleasure sensors in your brain in the same way that drugs stimulate those sensors. And so if that's happening, then you know, when you're not having that food, you're basically in withdrawal. And when you have that food, you just kind of get all mellow and nice. One of the things we know, like, for example, happens with sugar. There was one study they did where they gave some people a can of 75 milliliter or typical can of soft drink. Mm-hmm. And they did a CAT scan or an MRI of their brain, and they looked at the brain, and then they mixed those images of the brains with images of brains of people who had drug dependency issues. Mm-hmm. And the radiologists were not able to pull the different scans apart. They couldn't tell who was who.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, so I think part of it is definitely that. I mean, when we get this really nice feeling in our brain, we want to have it again, right?
Wow.
Part of it is cravings are associated with different events, you know? Like, I crave birthday cake at my birthday because my birthday is not my birthday until I had this birthday cake, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's many things that go into it.
Yeah.
And I don't think we've put our finger on the one thing, and it may be different things for different people.
Well, I think, you know, when it comes down to food, and just this is me just being a regular person, like, it's interesting to watch everyone's different attitude towards food, like, you know, whether people associate food with, like, emotional type stuff, like, oh, food makes me happy, so I'm eating lots of food, or I'm upset, so I'm going to eat some food. Like, it just seems like there's so many things tied around food. And people get either caught up in it or they don't know how to handle it properly, I guess. And then I guess cravings on top of that make it worse. And so I guess my point with that then is, how much is handling cravings like an attitude adjustment?
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And we're becoming, the behavioral scientists are starting to really learn more and more about it. And I mean, one of the things we know, that a lot of the people who have the most cravings are the people who spend the most time restricting themselves. So for instance, if you take someone who doesn't restrict what they eat, but they make choices, you know, they choose to eat because they're hungry, or they choose to eat something because it looks like it tastes good. They don't feel guilty about it. They eat it. They go on to the next thing. They actually tend not to have that many cravings, if they ever have any, versus somebody who's a restrictive eater and has all these rules and regulations about eating. They tend to get a lot more craving.
Okay? I can see that.
Yeah, and so we actually, there's in In her highly regarded book, Eat What You Love, Love What You Eat, How to Break Your Eat, Repent, Repeat Cycle by Dr. Michelle May, she actually discusses this cycle in great detail, where we go from, you know, where we're eating and we're restricting and then we eat again, and why we would do that. And that, there's a whole way of thinking that helps you to get out of that. And she actually has founded a whole series of workshops called Am I Hungry? Mindful Eating Workshops. And they really help break out of that cycle.
And where can people maybe check that out?
They can actually go to her website, which is www.amihungry.com.
Okay. And that's like, so obviously anyone around the world can check that out online.
Yes, actually there are facilitators all around the world who do these programs. I do the programs in Montreal, and Dr. May also facilitates program online.
Fantastic. Now, when it comes to, I guess, dealing with a craving, is it important the language that you use with yourself?
Yes, because I think it's really important to feel empowered when you're dealing with a craving. So when you say something like, I don't want to have this because I've chosen to have something else, or I don't want to have this because, that is an empowering way of thinking about it. When you're saying, I can't, that's actually taking the power away from you, and you're no longer in charge of the situation. And when you give the power away, that leaves you to fall prey to more cravings. And so that's really, really incredible and very powerful to just change those two little words from I can't to I don't.
Because I can't makes you feel deprived.
That's right.
Okay. Now, when you choose to ignore a craving, does it affect you in other ways then? Like, because I'm assuming, like, because I find a lot of times, you know, you as an individual person, like meaning me, you and whoever, you end up bargaining with yourself, you know, like, well, I'm not going to have this, but so I'm going to have 6 pounds of chocolate later. And I mean, I think we do it with a lot of different things in life. Like, I know as much as I love to work out, there's days where, like, for example, this morning, I did not feel like working out. And I managed to, I guess, get over it and work out anyways. But I find like a lot of times, you know, you end up bargaining.
Well, I think that's part of what making choices are about, where you can say, okay, I made the choice to work out even though I didn't really feel like it, because I know it's going to make me feel better later.
Because
it's about feeling better, right? So
yeah.
I know it's hard to get up this morning, but I know I'm going to feel really energized the rest of the day, and it's really worthwhile. So I'm going to push myself to do it. I'm trying to think of an example a client would give me. Okay, I know if I'm going to eat some red meat, for instance, I know I'm going to feel sluggish afterwards. So I have a meeting coming up and I don't want to feel sluggish. So I'm not going to eat red meat now, and I'm going to save it for supper time. That's a choice you're making. That's not denying the craving. That's just a choice you're making. And when you make those kind of choices, then it makes it it's not like saying, I can't have red meat. It's saying, look, I'm choosing not to have it now. So I didn't deny the craving.
You're just moving it around to a better
time. I'm just moving it around. If I want to have red meat later, I'll have it later. Now, who knows? Maybe later I'm not going to want to have it.
It's so weird how you do this to yourself, though, eh? Like, as a person, like, where, like, as soon as you feel like you're being deprived, all hell breaks loose.
It's very interesting. There's been a lot of research on this. And one of the latest studies that was done in the University of Houston is really interesting. It found that it's actually more effective to say, I cannot do something. It's more effective, 3 times more effective than saying no, and 8 times more effective than saying I can't. So that means you're really able to focus in on what you want to do and do what you want to do and make the choice because you want to do it.
Wow. Now, can you actually train your body to not want certain foods like chocolate or chips or, you know, salt versus sweet or whatever?
Over time, if you have less salt, over time you get used to it, and then you find that, you know, the foods that you eat that are really salty don't really taste that good. The same with chocolate, the same with sweets. I'm going to use an example. I used to like plain milk chocolate, and I decided, you know, it's kind of yucky because it's got too much sugar and it's got too much, you know, cream in it and everything. So I decided, and not enough cocoa. So I decided to have dark chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now if you give me milk chocolate, I think it's way too sweet. Yeah.
Good for you. I love milk chocolate. So That's a big problem for me.
Yeah, and it's just totally, it's like, no, I am not going to actually have this. Forget it. It's not happening. And I actually give the milk chocolate that comes in the house. I just give it to my husband. I don't even want to eat it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I need to get on that because I've tried. My mom actually is a huge dark chocolate person, not meaning she has it all the time. She's actually really great in the fact that she will buy like a Hershey bar of dark chocolate and it will last her like 2 weeks because she literally has one little corner piece after, I think, her lunch. And that just does her for the day. And I'm so proud of her because she just needs a little bit of whatever it gives her. And then that's it. So she can have like a chocolate bar like for 2 weeks and she just wraps it up and away she goes. And I don't eat any during the week. But on the weekend, my favorite is a Dairy Milk bar, the small one. And that's my little milk chocolate sad little affair that I have going on with it.
But you see, that's interesting because you don't have any during the week and you restrict yourself. You have a whole one during the weekend.
Yeah.
Whereas because your mom doesn't restrict herself and she has a little piece every day, or maybe not every day because if it lasts her 2 weeks, it's not even every day that she's having it because she just knows it's there and she can have it whenever she feels like it. She's the one who's in charge. And so she's able to say, you know what? I'm not going to have it today. I don't feel like it.
Yeah, she has a great attitude about that. And I think if more people would adopt stuff like that. And it's funny because when I was younger, I also had the mentality of that all or nothing. And I remember my grandma telling me, and it finally made sense to me after about 5 years after she said it. And I'm glad she did. It was, you know, moderation, because I used to be all or nothing. And then I was like, no, grandma, like moderation doesn't work for me. And now moderation works quite well. And I think it would work well for most people if they would adopt it, I guess, and maybe just go with it for a bit. And I wanted to ask you as well about giving yourself a treat though, every now and again. It is important to do that though, right, Kim?
Well, I always tell the story of the little 5-year-old, you know, who told me that chocolate chip cookies were a good snack. And I said, who told you that? And he said, my mom. And I nearly died because I thought, how am I going to tell him his mom's a twit? So he then said, so why does your mom tell you chocolate chip cookies are good for you? And he said, well, because they're good for my soul. And I think that's true. Some foods are good for our, so, you know, we want to eat them. We want to choose them, like your piece of birthday cake at your birthday or a glass of wine now and again, whatever. And I think that's fine to have. I think it's a question of the all or nothing. Like I find it really fascinating, these people who have cheat days. And they have these, you know, full days where, I don't know, they eat more garbage in 24 hours than I probably eat in a year. They look forward to it all week. They plan it and plan it and plan it. Whereas if you know what, if you didn't plan to have this cheat day, you might actually decide that you didn't want to eat this stuff.
Yeah, right. Yep. It's weird how
people
get...
decide that, you know what, it's really not that much fun eating ribs. And I really, okay, I'm going out for supper because, you know, we're going out. But I'm actually going to order some different, I don't know, I'm going to order the fish that's the baked fish. And I'm going to order some veggies. And I'm going to have a healthy meal. And you can do that.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can.
You just have to make sure that you give yourself the choice and that you feel empowered and in charge.
I like that. And I feel like what you said just makes a bunch of sense. Because again, when people start feeling denied, that's when, again, it's like they turn into like Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And unfortunately, when that happens, we end up in this really all or nothing approach. And we know that the all or nothing is not sustainable. It's really difficult to sustain. So it's fine to be all one way for a little while, or all another way for a little while. But either way, it's not sustainable. So we have to work on finding a middle ground.
Now, what would be your piece of advice, I guess, as we wrap things up for people when it comes to, you know, these detox cleanses and then, again, the cravings?
Well, I think the two pieces, I guess, two little bits of advice I could give people is, first of all, if you're not really putting a lot of toxins in, don't use the cleanses as a reason to put toxins into your body in the meantime. So just try and again, find a middle ground. And in terms of the cravings, really try and empower yourself. You are the one who has the power to choose which foods you want to have and how much exercise you want to do. So make sure, you know, that you're choosing them for the right reasons. Make sure you're choosing the ones you want and the ones that are healthy for you and that your body nourished your body.
Fantastic. Kim, thank you so much. And if people have questions, you know, can they email you ever?
Sure, they can email me. They can leave a message through my website. Or I also have a Facebook page, Kim Airy Nutrition, and they can message me there.
Fantastic. That's our consulting dietitian, Kim Airy. Again, make sure to check out her website, kimairy.com.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Even for the most skilled schmoozer, meeting someone special can be a challenge. But don't worry, our relationship coach is here with one way of meeting many people in just one evening, speed dating. Please welcome back to the show, Frank Kermit. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Kelly. How you doing?
I am fantastic. Thank you so much for being here. Now, can you tell me, I guess, how speed dating works and how many people you can actually meet in just one meeting or one evening? Because I know that speed dating has been around for a while now.
Well, let's answer the second question first. The number of people you can meet, assuming that you're going to talk to somebody for 5 to 7 minutes, that's up to 12 people an hour. And if it's a 2 or 3 hour event, you can meet anywhere from 24 to 36 new people, potentially, at a speed dating event. And the way it works, the girls come in and they all take a seat at small tables. And the guys come in and each guy sits in front of one girl. They have a 5 to 7 minute conversation. They rate each other as, yes, I would like a potential date with this person, or no, I would not want a potential date with this person. And when the bell rings, they move over to the next person. So all the guys get up and the girls stay seated and the guys just move over one seat. And this process continues. He talks to her for 5 to 7 minutes, moving on until everybody has had a chance to talk to everybody. At the end of the night, everybody submits their reports to the speed dating organizers, listing who they would like to date again and who they would not. The organizers look to make matches. When they find that two people have both said they want to date one another, they contact those people and say, here's the other person's contact information. Then it's up to the individual to decide to take it forward and actually set up a real date.
Okay. Now, since you're only with each person for this 5 to 7 minute, you know, time frame, what are some good questions to ask in that time period?
Well, one of the things that I always recommend is to stay away from questions that have nothing to do with how a person is going to treat you. Asking somebody where they work, what they do, what their favorite color is, and so on, it's great information. But it's statistical information. It has nothing to do with how the person is going to treat you in a relationship. It has nothing to do with whether or not the two of you have compatible values. So you're better off sticking to questions that are fun, lighthearted, and are designed to make a person reveal their soul. One of the questions that I recommend people ask is to say a hypothetical. If you were to win $1 million in the lottery, what's the first thing you would do? Now, a person who values a good time might say something like, oh, the first thing I would do, I would quit my job, get on a plane, I wouldn't take anything with me, and I would just travel the world and go to these different countries, and when I come back, I'll just deal with everything. That's a very different answer than someone saying, well, I think I would pay off my debts, pay off the house, or if I don't have a house, I would buy a house. I would make sure that my kid has an education fund, and then with whatever's left over, maybe I would invest that. And these type of answers really reveal what a person's priorities are. If somebody answers in a way that is compatible with what you value, you have found a match. If somebody answers in a way that's really just the opposite of what you would want to do in that exact situation, now you know that is not a match. You're looking for people who you could be compatible with so that you could have a great date afterwards.
There has to be all sorts of people coming out to these events. Do you have, I guess, you know, any tips on how to weed out maybe the desperate people and try to find the more interesting people that you might actually want to know better?
Look, in 5 to 7 minutes, you're not always going to be able to tell who the red flags are unless you go in with really great questions and you already know what your criteria is. So, no, there is no way to weed that out, the same way there's no way to weed out the red flag people in other areas of your life. It's just going to take time. The key thing to remember is that you have to go in there with an open mind and say, everybody here is dateable, and if I come up with a reason not to date the person, I'll say no. That's the best possible mindset, because all this is a 5 to 7 minute meeting. You still have to go on an actual date, and when you go on an actual date, you make it a simple coffee date. You meet up for 20 minutes or maybe an hour over lunchtime, And if you still don't connect there, hey, it's been great, thanks a lot. But at that point, you know that the other person has as much interest in you as you in them. So there's much more of an incentive, and it's a lot easier to get out to that first date.
Now, Frank, this might be something you can't answer, but I'm assuming you might be able to. With regards to the organizers or the organization that is organizing the speed dating event, do they do any sort of background checks in advance, or can anyone sort of willy-nilly come in? I just want people to be aware of, you know, maybe it is sort of fend for yourself, really, in this event.
To my knowledge, it's usually fend for yourself. In my experience, very few speed dating companies ever do any sort of background checks. They usually try to match people up based on, let's say, theme, whether it's religion, sexual orientation, sometimes age groups, and that's about it. You're basically meeting for people for 5 to 7 minutes, and it's up to you to decide if you're willing to take a chance and meet them up for a coffee date afterwards. So to my knowledge, no, they don't do any sort of background checks. It's not a matchmaking company. It's not a matchmaking system. It's not where... It's not a situation where they're putting too much stake involved. It's really just a fun opportunity to meet new people, as many new people as possible, in the shortest time possible.
Now, we talked earlier about the 5 to 7 minutes and what types of questions you should be asking. Now, taking from that in the conversation during those 5 to 7 minutes, what pieces, I guess, do you sort of decide off of if, you know, this is going to warrant a further date? Like if, I guess, any of the answers are really sort of hitting some buttons with you?
Well, let's look at a particular question that I normally ask people to take part in. And I'm going to ask this question to you, and then we're going to decipher the answer to that question, okay?
Yep.
So the first, here, so Kelly, here's the question. If life were a banana split, what part of that banana split would you be and why?
Okay, so then I would answer that.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that's a tough question, Frank. I guess I would say the ice cream, just because I think everyone thinks that's the best part of it.
Okay, so let's decipher that answer. You would be the ice cream because everybody else thinks the ice cream is the best part of it. This tells me that you want everybody to think that you're the best part of it. Other people's opinions maybe are very important to you.
Okay.
Now, if I'm very similar-minded, if I say, well, I would be the cherry because everybody loves a cherry, we would be compatible in the sense that the cherry and the ice cream are metaphors for the things that you and I both value.
Okay.
If, however, I would give the following answer, and this was a great answer I got from someone many years ago, his answer was, I would be the spoon because the spoon controls everything.
Right. Okay.
Now, somebody might look at that and say, I really like that person. It's very dominant. It's very, you know, lots of self-confidence behind that. Someone else might get that same answer and say, you know, that sounds like a control freak to me. I see that as a red flag. So, no, I don't want to date this person. So that's how you're going to decipher it. That's why asking these type of fun questions, which really reveal a person's values, is a lot more effective in trying to weed out people that you would not want to date. So let's try a different conversation, Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
If I came to you and I said, okay, well, what is it you value in life? Let's have that conversation.
Okay.
Putting it out there. What is it you value in life?
I would say, like, traits, like I would say, like, honesty and trust, all that sort of good stuff.
Right. But most people would say that.
Okay.
How they interpret honesty and trust and what the exceptions are to those boundaries is very, very individualistic and unique.
Okay.
That's why those questions don't work, because everybody's going to say the same thing.
Because they're too vague.
Exactly.
Okay.
But if I ask you a question like, well, let's try another one. If life was a vegetable garden, mm-hmm. what vegetable would you be and why?
Wow, Frank, you are making me work tonight. I don't even know. I guess I would say a cucumber, because I think that that's one of the most popular things you can have in the garden and the salad, and it just makes everything come together.
Okay, so let's look at the values that that expresses. Number one, it's one of the most popular things in the garden. This tells me that being popular and being liked, a theme that came up before with a different question, are things that are really important to you. So if I'm on the same level as you and I'm given a similar answer, I know that you would be a great match for me. You've also said about bringing an entire salad together. Maybe that's expressing a value such as you enjoy togetherness. You like being the point person who brings everybody together. maybe it says that you want to manipulate and control other people, and that's how somebody might interpret that. So they're going to ask a different question to see exactly where to pinpoint that value. Sometimes they may even ask you, well, listen, you want to be the cucumber. Why is it that a cucumber brings the entire salad together? Why is that important to you? And then you continue on with a conversation like that.
Okay.
If you only base it on statistical information, you're more often than not, you're going to be matched up with the wrong people.
I think this is fascinating. I think it's very important that you're bringing this up, Frank, because I think so many people go to these events. First of all, I've never been, but I was actually, you know, in preparation for this interview, I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, I think I would be very nervous at one of these events, and because I think I'm actually a shy person meeting new people like that. Like, I sort of need to sort of warm up to people, so I don't know how I would do just meeting, you know, 25 people in 7-minute spans. Like, I'm not sure how that would work. But the question that you've brought up is you need to be prepared so that you are not just asking mundane, inane questions that are not going to give you anything.
Exactly. Now, let's talk about the fact that a lot of people show up and are very nervous. One of the mistakes that I used to make when I started speed dating is that the first couple of people I would run into, they would say, well, I'm really nervous. And I would spend my time with them trying to calm them down and make them feel more comfortable. That was a mistake, because there's nothing attractive about that. We're not getting to know each other. I'm just filling into a therapist role.
Right.
And that's the wrong thing to do. What I learned is that when somebody says, well, look, I'm really, really nervous, then I would go into these type of value-eliciting questions. All of a sudden, the person starts talking about themselves, and they start thinking about what it is that's important to them. They stop being nervous because they're now talking about their absolute favorite subject, themselves. So everybody is going to be nervous starting out. Rather than talk about the nervousness, ask somebody a question and take a genuine curiosity about the other person so that that person expresses themselves and you get to know them.
Joining us on the program is our relationship coach, Frank Kermit. Make sure to check him out on his website, franktalks.com. Frank, how long should you wait before contacting one of your matches?
When it comes to speed dating, you don't wait. The day you get the information from the organizer saying this person matched up with you, here's the person's phone number and or email, you contact them that day and you set up a date as soon as possible. This is not a time to play games. This is not a time to follow any sort of rule, such as you have to wait 3 days to call because you don't want to appear desperate. This is a situation where two people have both admitted that they want to go out. Well, there's nothing to hide. There's nothing to be coy about. You've both admitted that you want a date. You know, when you realize that you want to spend time with someone, the best possible way to get that done is as soon as possible. So go ahead, set up a coffee date, set up a lunch date, a dinner date, whatever the case is, but make sure to set something up, reach out and connect with someone. Here's one of the things that happens. Chances are people end up with more matches than just the one or two. Sometimes they can end up with 7 or 8 matches from a speed dating event. Some people, not all, but some people will date the first person who reaches out to them. They go out on a date and they end up deciding, no, I just want to date this one person because they were the first person to reach out to me. So if you really liked someone, but you waited 2 or 3 days before you actually call that person and contact that person, even if they really liked you, they might be the type of person to only get serious and exclusive with somebody just because the other person reached out first. You want to meet each person as soon as possible, ideally in the same week, and then take it from there as to whether or not you want to date them further.
Now, Frank, because I know that you would have already thought about this, what type of date do you have? Like, because I feel like this is important. Do you just go for the coffee date? Like, how do you know what to propose?
Well, I would normally suggest to people that whatever their MO for a first date is, that's what they would do. Because, as you said, there's no background checks with speed dating, a public setting would be the best place. You go out to a coffee shop, a restaurant, a place where other people will see you. Make sure that you have a friend or a relative that has your contact information just in case, you know, anything goes wrong. To my knowledge, that hasn't happened yet, but you never know. The idea here is that you want to meet publicly where it's safe until you feel more comfortable to take it to a more private setting. Now, people are individuals when it comes to this, and some people feel very comfortable saying, hey, let's have dinner at my place. And if you're dealing with two people who are very comfortable in taking those kind of risks, well, they're probably going to do that in any dating system, you know, meeting anybody through the internet or whatnot. The idea is be safe. try to meet in a public place if you can. And if you're going to meet in a private place, understand that you're taking the same kind of risks as you would meeting somebody off the internet.
When you speak about being safe and stuff, is it important that maybe when you decide what speed dating event you're going to go to, that you go to like a theme night or something that really is sort of close to your heart or close to your understanding, so that you're already in a comfortable maybe way of making a decision?
Well, depending on what you're looking for. If you're looking just to meet people and have fun, then there's a lot more speed dating events open to you. If you're looking for something more serious, then you would have to start looking what your criteria is in terms of a long-term partner, type of future you want. Maybe because of those issues, you have concerns about age, you have concerns about religion, you have concerns about culture. If those things matter to you, then yes, you go to the speed dating events that would cater to those particular interests. It doesn't necessarily make it easier. It just might be in line with your goals, depending on what your goals are.
Now, when you do go out on this first post-speed dating date, like your first date, I guess, do you have any specific tips, Frank? Because, again, we just saw how important it is to have the right questions for the 5 to 7 minute speed dating. What do you do on the actual first date?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to let the other person know what it was about them that you found most interesting. During the speed dating event, most participants are encouraged to take notes. And before you hand in your quote-unquote report card to the organizer, make sure that you jot down some notes, including the person's name, things that they brought up in that five-minute conversation that you found very interesting, so that when you meet up with them on that first date, you're looking to continue a number of the conversations that were started in those first 5 to 7 minutes. This is for a number of reasons. First and foremost, you want to show the person that you actually remember them and that you're not getting them confused with somebody else that you were looking to match up with. This creates a lot of rapport and is a really good basis to really establish something really fun, a great dynamic, and maybe something that could lead to something more serious. The other thing that you want to do is that as they bring it up, make sure that you're not just looking to get information out of them, but you're trying to find out what kind of a role they can play in your life. If you're only looking for just something, you know, for a good time, and you're not looking for anything serious, get to know the person first. And if at the end of the date you still feel that way, and basically the person might be a great person, but not what you're looking for right now, you can be honest about that, and, you know, you're both free to move on. Just keep something in mind. If you plan to do one speed dating event, chances are you're going to try multiple speed dating events. And when you go to a new speed dating event, you're likely going to run into people that you met at the previous events, even people that you dated for a while. It's going to happen. So keep that in mind before you do anything that might burn a few bridges.
Now, I don't really want to bring this up, but I know that I have to. What happens if in that initial speed dating event you don't have any matches at all? Like, do you cry?
If you don't have any matches at all, the question you have to ask yourself is, I wonder if anybody wanted to date me that I wasn't open to. Because this is a very serious situation. Now, first of all, there are a number of speed dating organizers that say, if you don't get any matches, you're allowed to come back to another event for free or at a discount until you get at least one match. The other thing to consider is, if you're not getting any matches at all, are you communicating in a way that's creepy? Are you saying things to turn people off? Maybe that there's someone who's interested in you, but you're just not comfortable or maybe just not aware of being able to read the signs when someone is into you. When I first started speed dating, I went to a lot of speed dating events because I wanted to get good at it. The first couple of events, I was having a great time. We were talking. I thought we were connecting, and I got zero matches. At one point, I decided I'm going to give yes to everybody. This was an experiment I ran. I went to a speed dating event, and I said yes, even the ones who I knew I did not want to date. I said yes to all of them because I wanted to see if there was anybody who would match up with me. At this particular event, out of everybody I talked to, there was one person that I simply said, anybody but her. She just said the wrong thing. She just, you know, her entire demeanor was just a total turnoff for me. And I said, I'm still saying yes to her, but, you know, anybody else but her. I only got one match that night. Guess who I got?
With the lady.
I got the one person who I didn't want to be with. And I couldn't figure out why, because with everybody else, I was being very out there and very charismatic and almost a little bit over the top. But when I got to her and she started saying things that really turned me off, I kind of backed off a bit. And I had a, what I thought was a pleasant conversation, but I wasn't really trying hard. And that's when I realized that that was the formula that works for me. So I went to a following speed dating event, and this time I took the same demeanor throughout all of my conversations. And wouldn't you know it, out of about, let's say, 15 or 20 people who were eligible, I ended up with 7 matches. It's not so much about the fact that other people may not be into you or you being too picky. Sometimes we don't realize how we come across that might be turning people off. Speed dating is a great way to practice. It's a great way to find out and experiment with behaviors that might make you realize and teach you something about yourself, about the way you've come across.
Now, speaking of that, Frank, the fact that, you know, we can maybe lump that into being socially awkward in a way, because there are some people, I think, that are just painfully shy and whatever. So in that moment, even though you might be a perfectly well-adjusted person, you're coming off as socially awkward. How do you adjust that then, like in the grand scheme of things, even to just get over the hump of getting to one of these events and not being painfully shy?
Okay, well, the first thing you can do is when you're talking to somebody, if you really happen to like them, there's nothing wrong with saying, look, I just want you to know I'm just really, really shy. So if I come across as socially inept, I'm actually well adjusted. It's just I get really shy and really nervous and I forget how to communicate. But once I get to know somebody and feel safer with somebody, I'm much more relaxed. If you start the conversations with something like that, you're basically giving the other person a filter so that when they see you're getting nervous, they may even call you out on it. They might say, hey, are you feeling nervous right now? Yes, actually, I am. So the person knows, so this person isn't creepy. They're just really shy. They know how to filter it. And you're being honest about it right from the get-go, so it takes a lot of pressure off. In terms of finding the courage just to get out there to such an event, I got to tell you, speed dating is not unto itself with this challenge. Every dating challenge has this. Every new way of meeting people has this. You got to fight that fear of rejection, that fear of the unknown. The chances are that the soulmate that you're looking for, the next person who's going to be an amazing person in your life and in your love life history, is someone you don't know right now. Chances are that your future lover, your future partner, is currently a stranger to you. And for me, the best motivation to get out there is that the more people I meet, the closer I get to meeting my soulmate.
That's a good way of looking at it. Now, Frank, as well, if things don't go well on that initial speed dating night, you know, what's your advice? Because I think some people might just give up right away and be like, I sucked at this. I am clearly not made out for speed dating. I'm going to do something else. Like, do you suggest maybe needing to do it a couple of times because maybe you just were not in the right frame or super shy or super scared those first few times?
I will take the attitude of not every dating method is for everyone. Some people are very comfortable with online dating. Other people want to be introduced by friends. Some people are very comfortable being set up on blind dates. Other people just, you know, are terrified of them. You got to find what works for you. Now, if you try speed dating and you don't get any matches that first time, I would say take that as a sign that there's something that you're doing or saying that's coming across in a way that's probably not painting the proper picture of who you are. I would always recommend to people keep speed dating. If for no other reason than to experiment with different behaviors, different stories, different ways to come across, and be a lot more open as to who you say yes to for a potential first date, that is going to tell you more than anything else. That's going to tell you how you're coming across and helping you find a way that best represents you when you go out on a date.
Frank, before I let you go, what is your most important piece of advice for anyone who is going to attempt speed dating?
Don't go in there with unrealistic expectations. That's the biggest piece of advice. Don't go in there assuming that everybody who's there is desperate. Don't go in there expecting to find your soulmate. This is an opportunity to meet a lot of people, and you're going to meet some great people, and you're going to meet some not-so-great people for you. If you go in there with unrealistic expectations, you are sure to be disappointed. Go in there with an open mind and looking to have some fun in meeting as many people as possible. That really is the best advice. I got to tell you that in all the speed dating events I did and all the people that I met and went on a few dates with, I actually met one of the best girlfriends in my life through speed dating. That's why I'm so such a supporter of speed dating. I met somebody who was really amazing that because of where her life was at, where my life was at, there wouldn't have been a chance for us to meet in other circumstances. It was a great way for us to connect. We had a great relationship. Unfortunately, we were incompatible for certain things, and that's why the relationship ended, but we're still on good terms today. And I tell you, you can meet a great person speed dating, but don't go in there with the expectation that it's going to be the be-all and end-all and the answer to your woes. It's just another means to meet people. I just personally think it's a fun one.
Frank, thank you so much as always. This is great advice.
Kelly, it's always a pleasure to be on the Kelly Alexander Show.
That was our relationship coach, Frank Kermit. Again, for more information, make sure to visit his website, www.franktalks.com.
Bring on the remix.
There's something in the air tonight. I can feel it taking over. We're gonna watch the sunrise and lift the world off our shoulders.
That's Jess Wright with Dance All Night, the JRMX radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. Now, as per usual, I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time coming from Ralph Marston, "Winners and losers both stumble. The winners are the ones who quickly get back up and keep on going." Now, next week on the show, we have an awesome guest for you, Australian singing sensation Cody Simpson's manager, Matt Graham. Matt talks about what it's like to be an artist manager and also all the duties that he needs to get through to keep making Cody successful and comfortable and take his career to the next level. So that's coming up next week on The Kelly Alexander Show. Now, we'd love for you to be checking out our YouTube channel. We've been uploading all of our celebrity interviews, so make sure you check them out. YouTube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Also, we'd love for you to follow our Twitter account @KAlexanderShow. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.